You are listening to Over and Back's Basketball Mysteries of the 1970s. Today's mystery is, who were the wildest team owners? Hello, welcome back to Over and Back. I am Jason. With me as usual is Rich, and we are talking about the wild and craziest team owners in the NBA and the ABA of the 1970s.
Yeah, I don't know if I can decide which one is the... I know that we our goal with this is to answer this question, but this is going to be a tough one. There's a lot of contenders here. We'll get to
it. All right. Yeah, it's obviously, you know, one of the things about this decade is, you know, with the expansion and with, you know, all of the new owners that are being brought in that we've talked about in other shows, you're just getting new new blood to this, you know, new money, as they call it, to this league. And it leads to some owners who are not necessarily like the, you know, the conservative types that were around in the 50s and 60s, who were, you know, mostly guys who the team was their main business rather than being in addition to other businesses. So this just adds a whole new dimension. In the ABA, there's very much this, you know, they're kind of letting almost anybody, you know, who has the money get a team. They're not really that discerning about who the ownership group is. So it leads to some eccentric ones. I think the craziest stories are probably in the ABA, but the NBA, some of those owners give them a run.
No, they do pretty good, too. Yeah, the NBA does a pretty good job themselves. We'll start with the Dallas Chaparrals, which isn't one particular guy. It's kind of an ownership group, but they had their wildness as well. They were known for their vast wealth, their group, which included future mayor of Dallas, Bob Folsom. They were estimated to be around a worth of about $480 million to $750 million. So they were definitely a very valuable team, but not ran very well. This predates the 70s by a little bit, but it's still a very great story. And Terry Pluto's loose balls. Max Williams, who was Dallas's GM at that time, he couldn't attend the draft. So he gave Roland Spieth, who was one of Dallas's owners. This is prior to the Bob Folsom ownership group, but related in some way. So he gave them... he gave him his draft sheet and said, you know, this is an alphabetical list of guys, you know, here, you know, just different stuff of, okay, here's guys that I like, here's this sort of stuff. Well, here's the quote from the Loose Balls, and this is the story as told by Max Williams. So Roland Spieth, so it comes to Max Williams, he said, well, we had our draft. Max says, I said, what are you talking about? It happened so quickly. They just said the draft was tomorrow. I couldn't find you, but I took your list along. Of course, the reason Spieth went by himself is that he didn't want to spend the money to take me along too. This is Max Williams, of course, telling the story. I said, you should have taken me. You don't know anything about these players. And he said, I got the first five guys on your list. I said, that wasn't a talent list. That was a list of players in alphabetical order. And he said, oh. So he gave him a list of guys in alphabetical order. This guy assumed it was a list of talent. And so the first pick of the Dallas Chaparrals was Matt H. from Michigan State. That's spelled A-I-T-C-H. Next pick was Jim Burns, followed by Gary Gray. Pat Riley jumps in there. He's a little bit of an interesting one. Jamie Thompson, Paul Bredaris, I believe it is, Jeff Finch, Ted Manning, Dwayne Heckman, Gilbert McDowell, Jerry Southwood, and Tom Storm. But... none of those guys really turn out to do anything at Salal. Of those picks, only Jim Burns, who was the second pick, he played 36 games, an average 4.4 points per game for Dallas. Burns was also drafted by the Chicago Bulls in the fourth round of the NBA draft, so he's not completely out there. He's maybe somewhat of a talent, more so than the rest of these guys. Nobody else on that list played anything significant for Dallas. So, yeah, the alphabetical draft was not a success.
No, so. Not so much. Not so much. So, another one, and... we talked about this a little bit with Raphael. I talked with him when we were talking about the about some of the trades. Earl Foreman, the owner of the Virginia Squires, was very much known for selling off his players. And he was a member of the ownership group, the main owner, that purchased the Oakland Opes, who were about to fall deep into bankruptcy, owned by Pat Boone in 69. But he came in and they paid $2.6 million for the team, moved it to D.C., where it became the Washington Capitals. Didn't work out so well there, so then they moved to Virginia for the next season. And so immediately they had to trade Warren Armstrong, later Warren Jabali, to the Kentucky Colonels for a draft pick and cash. And then he sold Rick Barry to the New York Nets. It was reported at $250,000, but I think it was later actually a relatively small amount of money, like $25,000 or something. It was reported as a larger sum because he wanted to kind of save face, but basically Barry didn't want to be there and he had to kind of get out of it. So, and Barry even later said like he would have bought out his contract for a larger amount of that, but they wanted to keep Barry in the ABA, understandably. Then the Squires did pretty well though. They stuck around. So even without Rick Barry, the Squires finished in first in the East, 55-29, and they even did pretty well in the playoffs. They beat the Nets 4-2, beating Rick Barry, in fact. But they lost in the Eastern Division Finals to the Colonels. And then afterward, they signed Julius Erving to a four-year, $500,000 contract. Erving was, he was a good college star at UMass, but was not a significant name at that time. He was from a smaller school and was not necessarily that well-known in the league, but he had been scouted by the Squires, and they liked him, and so they did pretty well in the postseason. They ended up losing the 7-game Eastern Division Finals to the Nets 4-3. Rick Barry team beating them, and then 73 they struggled a little bit. They just didn't really have much depth around Julius, and also Julius had tried to jump to the Atlanta Hawks in the offseason between 72 and 73 offseasons, which we'll get into more in a different episode. But even so, Foreman had added George Gervin to the Squires roster, which had two future Hall of Famers on the same team. But they traded Erving and Willie Sojourner to the Nets for George Carter and $1 million. And then later on, they would sell Sven Nader to the Spurs for $300,000. So they keep finding this great talent and then trading. Although Nader had played for UCLA, although he had been a backup to Bill Walton, so he hadn't gotten a whole lot of time. And then and we talked about this a little bit in the NBA trades contest, but Gervin was actually traded to the Spurs for $225,000, but they held off the deal so that Gervin could play for the Squires at the All-Star game, which the Squires hosted. And then, then the trade was consummated afterward. Foreman actually tried to get out of the trade, but eventually the Spurs insisted and everyone relented, and they kept Gervin, who of course, would be the franchise player for them for the next decade. And the team came to an end, like I said, just about a month before the NBA-ABA merger, because they were unable to pay a $75,000 league assessment. So they were out of the $3 million that the ABA teams got for being bought out, or for being part of the merger, or even, of course, the greater deal that the Sonos brothers were able to get that we talked about before. However, he was able to he did bounce back a little bit at Foreman. He helped create the Major League Indoor Soccer League, which is actually quite a it was a very brief sensation in the late.
It stayed around for a long time too. I mean, people kind of forget how long that league was around, but yeah, like you're saying, it was kind of
it was very popular for a few years in the late 70s, and then kind of fell apart. But so he was the commissioner of that league for 7 years, and stuck around. So he managed to do better in a different sport. He's another guy who's a very good storyteller in loose balls, and enjoyable to your talk.
Now we'll move on to Charlie Finley in Memphis. You might know the name if you're a baseball fan. He was the eccentric owner of the Oakland Athletics, very successful Oakland Athletic team that all hated him because he was a penny pincher. He's kind of the same thing here as well. In 1970, he purchased the Memphis Pros of the ABA to accentuate the new direction of the team. He held a special contest to find a better nickname. So over 20,000 postcards were received during the course of the contest, and the winner collected a $2,500 prize for coming up with the nickname. The nickname that won was the Tams, and Finley thought this nickname was appropriate because the Memphis franchise supposedly had fans in both in Tennessee, Arkansas, and Mississippi. So you got the Tams, makes a lot of sense. Finley then quickly wanted to make the team the most colorful in the league, and that was something that he was always very good about doing in the MLB as well. So the logo became a kind of green, white, gold, weird color that's. A little like his Oakland Athletics team, but kind of a little bit more different. He hired recently retired Kentucky Wildcats basketball coach Adolph Rupp as team president. And then, of course, as Finley was wont to do, he ran it on a shoestring budget. And after the first season, he sold the team and returned to baseball. So it was interesting stuff. A few other little stories of him. In the middle of all the losing and cost cutting, he was not good, by the way. Finley took a bizarre step of offering all the Tams players, coaches, and male front office personnel a special $300 bonus to grow a mustache. He had taken the same approach with the Oakland A's, famously. And, Raleigh Fingers was known for his his handlebar mustache and other guys. Several players took the offer very seriously, grew full mustaches, and hopefully got the promised bonuses out of Finley, but a lot of dubious claims that he never paid anybody. Finley did not bother to attend any games, by the way, during the TAM's second season. He would sometimes go weeks without communicating with the coach, who was Butch Van Brennikoff, about roster moves and team business. He was just kind of out of sight, out of mind. He did also implement some cost-cutting measures. For example, he took the approach of eliminating the publication of game programs. TAM fans had to make up their own typed lineup sheets. And the Memphis fans, sensing the futility of the entire operation, stayed away in droves, and the lack of attendance late in the season approached lows only previously seen in the ABA by the Houston Mavericks. And then, of course, as I mentioned, that was it for Finley, who got out as quick as possible. So,
yeah, and the team actually shut down completely and, you know, basically was about to fold and then was sort of saved by Mike Storin, who had been the ABA commissioner and who had been the front office in for the Pacers and the Colonels. And, you know, they tried to make a go of it. That didn't work out a whole lot better, unfortunately. But there's one good story. I think it was Charlie Williams who told the story about how, you know, he's trying to negotiate a contract with Charlie Finley. And then he's going in, they're supposed to have lunch together, and he's going in, and like Charlie Finley's like heating up the soup and is like this hot plate. And he's like, oh, you know, he must not have, you know, have very much with, you know, if he's having to deal with this. So he ended up accepting a lesser amount, finding out later that was just sort of a trick that Finley liked to you know, not pay him, you know, be cheap. So.
Charlie. It's a good one, though. I like that.
Next.
I use it on some mortgage payment.
Yeah, there you go. Yes. You just get a hot plate.
If they bring a cup of ramen, they won't make me have to pay, right?
Foreclosing your house, yeah.
I like that.
Yeah. John Y. Brown, the owner of the Kentucky Colonels.
I'm in no danger, by the way. So don't. I mean, you can send money if you want, but I'm in no danger of. I was just telling people I am in no danger of foreclosing on my home. But if people want to send me money or me or Jason money, that's fine. But just to let you know, I'm not in.
All right, fair enough. So. You know, support our sponsors.
Yes.
John Y. Brown of the Kentucky Colonels. He was able to. The team was about to be sold to a group from Cincinnati. But then he ended up purchasing the Wendell Cherry's interest from the group, really to keep the team from there. And then he put his wife and a 10-woman board of directors in charge of the team, which actually they launched an effective ticket-selling campaign across the state, actually tripled ticket sales for the 74 season, doubled attendance. And however, the Colonel's general manager, Mike Storin, who we just mentioned, felt that he really couldn't answer to this, and this was unacceptable, and that he thought that Brown was going to run the team his way, left the team as a result, and then 2 months later he became the ABA League commissioner. So and he said he owned the team, and if he wanted to run it, he'd run it. Since I can't work under those conditions, I decided to quit. Then the head coach, Joe Mullaney, followed soon after, saying Brown was going to be too meddlesome in personnel decisions. And Babe McCarthy lasted only one season as Mullaney's replacement. And in 75, Brown hired Huey Brown as head coach. The team won the ABA championship the following year, although things did not go well between the two Browns, and Huey Brown was out of there as well. The Colonels were a effective team in the late 70s, but were always kind of, you know, one thing over getting over the hump. They finally did when they won the championship with Huey as their head coach in the 75 season. Although he'd been hailed as a hero for saving the Colonels and bringing the championship, he then was publicly criticized because after the championship, they sold the rights to Dan Issel in a cost-saving move. And then at the end of the year, he accepted a $3 million offer to fold the team rather than paying $3 million to join the NBA, and then later bought a Buffalo Braves team for, I believe, $500,000. So made a pretty good deal for himself, but, you know, the people of Louisville otherwise might have an NBA team today if he had not decided to do that. So,
And also he's an executive with the Kentucky Fried Chicken Corporation as well.
Yes.
So that's,
executive? He might have actually been the owner. He was later the governor.
I think, he was the owner. Yeah, correct.
He was
the
governor of Kentucky as well. So he was, he was a prominent person, and would later, after getting the Braves, of course, to be the famous, the Braves, who became the Clippers and Celtics franchise swap that we talked about in previous episodes. But he would end up being the owner of the Celtics for a while and would clash with Red Auerbach and eventually would sell the Celtics, I'm sure, for a hefty profit. So
All right, next on our list, Dr. Lenny Bloom of the San Diego Conquistadors. Yes, he is a part-time orthodontist and a full-time operator of the San Diego Conquistadors, which is fantastic. I want a current NBA owner to also do orthodontist work on the side. That would be incredible. It was not great. Leonard Bloom, he had a personality conflict with Peter Graham, who was the proprietor of the city's San Diego's their brand new $14,000 seat sports arena. Graham was angry that the ABA had granted the expansion franchise to Bloom and not him. So he retaliated by refusing to lease the sports arena to the Conquistadors. Out of necessity, the Conquistadors played at Peterson Gym on the campus of San Diego State. Peterson Gym had a capacity of about 3,000 and looked like a high school gymnasium. But as Leonard kind of sold it, the fans could get very close to the action. So that was a great selling point for the Conquistadors. And before the second season, Bloom and the Conquistadors captured the attention of the entire basketball world. They signed Los Angeles Lakers superstar Wilt Chamberlain to a $600,000 per year contract to play and coach for the team. Bloom told the San Diego Faithful, Wilt's my player coach with an emphasis on player. There's a bunch of stuff. You can find them out as well, where they sort of distributed media photos showing Wilt wearing the Conquistadors uniform, holding an ABA ball. They're ready to go. It's all set. November 7th, 1973, Bloom proposed a 20,000-seat arena in a $200 million development in suburban Chula Vista, and it failed by a mere 294 votes out of 19,000 cast in a special referendum. So very, very close to do that. On November 10th, the league, the ABA, ordered Bloom to begin preliminary investigations into moving the team northward to Los Angeles. And then much of the 73-74 season was overshadowed by the team, rumors that the team was going to move to Los Angeles. Publicist Anne Steele, he resigned midseason, saying that when I try to make an appointment for someone to interview Wilt, he's always too busy. The guy is just impossible to work with. Of course, the Wilt thing did not work out. He was not allowed to play for the team. He was only available to coach, and he was just not a very willing coach whatsoever. A month into the season, Dilly reminded Coach Chamberlain that the team picture had not been taken yet. When Wilt responded that it was too early and that there would be significant changes on the roster, Dilly decided that was it for me. And yeah, that was just a mess. The Wilt thing did not work. I mean, it's not a bad idea to do that. And I would have been definitely on board with seeing whatever he could do. But the idea that he was going to be a player while still under contract and stuff, it just didn't work all that well. And as a coach, he just was not very interested in sitting on the bench and coaching. So that kind of sunk the entire franchise and at least Dr. Leonard Bloom's tenure as the owner of that team.
Absolutely, yeah. And we're gonna have a little bit more in a future episode on Wilt's time in San Diego and whether if he had been able to play, whether that would have been able to make much of a difference for the ABA. But we'll get to that another time. Next owner is we're gonna look at some of the NBA owners now. Paul Snyder of the Buffalo Braves. Many local fans viewed him as a greedy man who sold the Braves to profiteer from John Y. Brown for an easy score, knowing they would be relocated. Although there's some split in that where some people actually think that he may have saved the Braves and spared the NBA from embarrassment years before their demise. And he actually was the owner. He was 33 years old when he took over the team in 1970. He was able to, he was really instrumental in being able to, build the team and finance the team. It was kind of a situation where, maybe the finances, started to get really expensive for him once the team started to have some success. They had, three rookies of the year in a row from 74 to 76, Bob McAdoo, Ernie DiGiorgio, and Adrian Dantley. And McAdoo was MVP in 75, and then Randy Smith was also a key player there. So they did have some good times, but they ended up having to trade away McAdoo and Dantley for financial reasons. They later would briefly get Moses Malone from the Portland Trail Blazers, and then would sell him for a couple of first-round picks and a bunch of cash. So they had to unfortunately have like a bunch of financially, motivated moves. And then as we talked about before, the team was sold to John Y. Brown, who ended up taking the team to, eventually, having that franchise swapped with the Clippers with Irv Levin. So he sort of was another one of these owners who kind of like seemed like they were like in over their head wanted to maybe do the right thing, but was unable to do so. And he paid for $4 million for the team, and then unfortunately only was sold it for, I believe, $500,000. So not a great financial deal for him.
No, and a lot of the issues, too, again, you kind of have to get a frame of reference for the NBA at this time. Even, you know, we talk about the ABA as this wild league or whatever. The NBA was still kind of working through their issues as well. And one of the big issues with this team and with Buffalo is that the Braves home arena, the Memorial Auditorium, they didn't get first dibs on dates. The NHL's Buffalo Sabres did. And then after that, the Kansas College got their dibs on the dates. So Snyder was kind of left with days during the week and some weekends, and that didn't really work for the NBA. So the NBA couldn't finalize the schedule until those other teams, the Sabres and the University, finished theirs, and it just caused a lot of issues, and it never worked out. Like, you know, Snyder, I think there was a quote in one of the articles I read that he was like, well, why can't the college play during the day? Like, we want to play at night. And the college was like booking Saturday nights and stuff like that just because they had the ability to, because why not? If we can, we will. And the Snyder was left with, yeah, doing weekdays and like weekend afternoons or whatever. So attendance just was never good in Buffalo, mostly because of that reason.
Yeah.
And he couldn't secure another arena deal as well, because it wasn't that easy to kind of snap your fingers and say, hey, build me an arena like it is now. So that sunk them for sure.
Yeah, and changing demographics in the 70s as well, with you know, the arenas just being more dependent on white collar, you know, of companies buying luxury boxes when they didn't have luxury boxes in, but getting the ticket base through, you know, selling them through companies, sure, and stuff. And then, you know, they just talked about very well in Breaks of the Game of, you know, how that another reason why things didn't work out so well, Buffalo.
Yeah, and Buffalo, not really a big boom town at that point,
right,
either. I mean, that was they were going through their own, you know, struggles economically, and like you said, demographics changing as,
sure,
well in the entire city.
Yeah.
So, all right, so move on to Jack Kent Cook of Los Angeles. We'll start with him in 1951. We'll start kind of back with how he came here. He was a Canadian media entrepreneur, and he ventured into sports. He acquired the Toronto Maple Leafs baseball club. They were a baseball team first. And he's well known, similar to kind of St. Louis Browns owner and Chicago White Sox owner Bill Veeck, of making games into kind of entertainment, special promotion, celebrity appearances, that sort of stuff. He actually won Executive of the Year, Minor League Executive of the Year, in 1952, and was well known as a guy who, hey, he knows how to market this stuff. This is pretty good. In 1965, he purchases the LA Lakers for $5 million. Under his ownership, they moved from the Los Angeles Memorial Sports Arena to the Forum, and he changed their colors from royal and light blue to the current purple, which is referred to as, of course, Forum blue and gold. A little bit of a backstory on that. Cook told the public commission that ran the LA Sports Arena that the lease terms the Lakers were to play there, or the lease terms they'd agreed to, were unacceptable. They would need to be changed, or he would build his own arena. They all laughed at him, so he said, well, screw you, I'm building my own arena, and he built the Forum in Inglewood. So it definitely worked out well. He's well known for, you know, acquiring Will Chamberlain or being one of the driving forces of the Lakers trading for Will Chamberlain. He won an NBA title. He in June 1968, he had them or encouraged them to acquire Will Chamberlain. So that led to him being so confident in Game 7 in the 1969 Finals, as we know, a famous upset by the Boston Celtics. He planned the victory celebration. He knew where the balloons were going to be. He put balloons in the rafters. He got champagne ready. He had everything ready to go. But unfortunately, the Celtics had much, much different plans, and, you know, a huge upset that we'll talk about, or have talked about a lot on this show, and we'll probably continue to talk about many times forward. And then he never got a chance to enjoy the magic Kareem years as an owner. He sold the Lakers in 1979 to Jerry Buss for $67.5 million, which is not a bad return on investment. This was the largest transaction in sports history, but mostly he probably would have stayed, but he had a gigantic divorce settlement of nearly $40 million at the time, which was the largest divorce settlement in history, and needed the money very quick, so he sold it to Jerry Buss for $67 million. But all in all, the Lakers during his ownership years, they reached 7 NBA Finals and won, of course, the 1972 NBA Finals. So not a bad run for Cook.
Yeah, he was. It's more for him that he was known for treating people really poorly and being incredibly arrogant. There's a story from after they won the 72 championship. Each Laker was paid a playoff bonus of $1,500 each, which was significantly less than the $5,000 each player had received in 71 when they didn't even make it to the finals. And then Cook also refused to give Coach Bill Sharman a playoff bonus, insisting the players should compensate Sharman on their own. And this led to a really there was a disaster at the end of season banquet where none of the players were willing to even speak with Jack Kent Cook. And Jerry West would really be angry with Kent Cook about this, and would eventually lead to a situation where he felt like, you know, Cook lied to him. He would hold out of training camp and would find out that Chamberlain was making more money than he was, even though, you know, he was told that he was, shared being the highest player of the they thought that both were being paid $250,000 when Chamberlain was actually being paid $400,000 a year. And then West basically quit the team and there was a lawsuit between the teams. So it was very contentious mm-hmm. on that end. So Ken Cook, you know, he actually ran the Lakers fairly well during the time which he owned them. And obviously creating the forum and all those things were, you know, it wasn't a bad owner, but by any stretch of the imagination, he was just a very, it was a very arrogant owner who liked to alienate his players and, was definitely sort of a, he was a very fussy man as well. And very like, there's an interesting, there's also one other story where, because he's still on the team when they draft or when before they drafted Magic, but when they were, I believe this was before they drafted, but they were meeting him. And then, you know, Cook was, they were at some fancy restaurant and Magic, he just wanted a hamburger. You know, he wasn't really comfortable in that situation. And then Cook basically just berated him for like ordering a hamburger. Like, how dare you order a hamburger? Just like had no concept of, you know, Magic came from a different world and that, you know, had a different thing and that, you know, he didn't appreciate this, you know, this hoity-toity stuff that Cook was all about. So not a people person is what I'm trying to say.
No, not at all. Yeah.
So next we have
speaking of people person.
Yeah, we decided to throw Ted Stepien in here, even though he took over the Lakers the Cavs in 1980 and lasted until 83. So a little outside of the official 70s, but we're not afraid to do that here. So he was an advertising businessman, and in an interview in December 1980. He said, no team should be all white and no team should be all black either. That's what bothers me about the NBA. You've got a situation here where blacks represent little more than 5% of the market, yet most teams are at least 75% black. So blacks don't buy many tickets and they don't buy many of the products advertising TV. Let's face it, running an NBA team is like running any other business, and those kind of factors have to be considered. So I guess the Hawks owners later, when they would have those, emails, that were expressing not quite as coded versions of the sentiment, I guess they were inspired by that. So, which is a pretty incredible thing to say in public, even in 1980. So,
right. Yeah. Even the 50s, you're like, yeah, that's cringy. But 1980 is like, all right. Like, really?
Yeah,
like,
you should be
any better by that point.
You should be smarter about your, even if you're racist, you should be smarter enough not to be so super public about it at that point. But yeah. So, as far as how he ran the team in,
great. Other than that, he was a PR nightmare, but he ran the team great.
Yeah, in 81 and 82, he fired three head coaches and hired four. At one point, the Cavs traded away five consecutive first round picks, which led to the Stepien rule, which lasts to this day. Which a team cannot trade its first round pick in consecutive years in most situations.
The greatest thing ever.
And then
it's got to be great having a rule named after you where it says like, please just stop being dumb. Like, just don't kill your team. Like, just stop. Like, just chill. Yeah. But Brooklyn really tried to break this rule. As we knew, that's when I first heard of this rule, is when Brooklyn, when the Nets were, all right, come on, we got to trade every. No, just calm down, guys. And as we still know. But yeah, just a fantastic rule. Five consecutive first round picks is just unbelievable.
Yes. And eventually the team actually froze, or the NBA actually froze the team's trading rights to prevent him from giving up any of the rest of the team's picks for the rest of the 80s and the 90s.
This is in 1980, by the way, where they said even through the 90s,
yes,
stop trading picks. Yes. Like, you cannot trade any more picks.
The freeze officially ended after 82, but then all trades were required the approval of the league's director of operations after 82. And then during his tenure as Cavs owner, the Cavs went 66-180, had five different coaches, and had losses of $15 million. So there was a threat.
But other than that, he was great.
Yeah, there was a talk that they were going to try to move to Toronto at one point, but that was averted, and they were, of course, able to stay in Cleveland.
Right. Other than losing a lot of money, losing team, having no PR, and being a horrible racist, everything else was great about him, though.
Yes, exactly. He had those awesome sunglasses that you...
He did have fantastic sunglasses. Yes. You can Google it right now, and you can see they are top 10 sunglasses of all time.
Exactly.
But he is a bottom 10 of all time owner, for sure. Irv Levin, we'll move on now. He was an American film producer and business executive. He and attorney Harold A. Lipton purchased the Boston Celtics for $3.7 million. The sale was initially rejected by the NBA as a result of conflict of interest because Levin, who was an executive of the National General Film Corporation, he had executive, or there were directors under him, with sort of Sham Shulman and Eugene Klein, and they owned the Seattle Supersonics. So they wondered if there would be kind of a conflict of interest there of having, you know, an executive and directors and all that sort of stuff of the same company owning different teams. So Levin and Lipton were forced to sell their shakes to Robert Schmertz for $3.95 million for, and this came with an option for the two to repurchase half of the Celtics stock later. Anyway, after 2 years of litigation, Levin and Lipton were able to exercise their option. And then 10 months later, they purchased the remaining stock. So they got it anyway, after all that. We talked about this a little bit, and you've also talked about this on a past episode. In 1978, Levin and Lipton swapped their shares of the Celtics with John Y. Brown, and they then became owners of the Buffalo Braves. The Braves relocated to San Diego, where they became the San Diego Clippers, and on May 4th, 1981, Levin sold the Clippers to another great man, Donald Sterling, for $13.5 million. And people might wonder, hey, why would you trade Boston? Why would you do that? One of the interesting things is Levin, you know, who had decent attendance in Boston, and, you know, the team missed the playoffs in 1978, rather, but he wanted a new franchise in San Diego because, if you remember, I said he was an executive of film. So he wanted to be near his home, which was in L.A. He wanted to be near or close to other West Coast business interests. So he said, yeah, you know, you can take Boston because that's way too far away from where I want to be. I'll take San Diego. That'll work fine for me. Of course, didn't work out all that well, but he was able to make it, of course, you know, $13.5 million out of the deal, selling the Clippers to Donald Sterling, which in retrospect, maybe it would have been better if he didn't. But hey, can't change history. So, yes.
So our last owner that we're going to look into is Franklin Muley, who was the owner of the Warriors for 24 years, actually, from when they moved to San Francisco in 64 up until the 80s. And they did actually they won a championship in 75 and had three NBA Finals appearances. He also he played a role in breaking down racial barriers in the NBA and encouraged the team's front office to sign players regardless of color. 10 of the 12 players on the title team were African-American, as was Al Addles and his assistant Joe Rogers. They were the Al Addles was the first African-American coach other than Bill Russell to win a championship. And his personal style was you call it eccentric, I guess. Instead of wearing, you know, a business dress, he was heavily bearded. He favored jeans, Hawaiian shirts, and a deerstalker cap. And when events became too complicated or he needed time to think or avoid the press, this is from a New York Times obit, he would simply disappear for a few days. He kept a number of motorcycles, his preferred mode of transportation, and occasionally forgot where he left them. So
this is a problem you often wrestle with, Jason, right? You just drive your motorcycle and you have no idea where you left it, and you just go, whatever, I'll get another one. I know you're always telling me, I'm going to be a little late to get on the show.
Exactly.
I left my motorcycle somewhere and I don't know where it is.
Absolutely. You know, that and I leave my car in the parking lot. Those are two things that I have trouble with, you know. I have to hit the beep, you know, to try to, you know, figure out.
That is tough. Yeah. Grocery store car finds is one of the most difficult things in the world.
Yeah. So after the Warriors won the title in 75, he put the trophy in the backseat of his sports car for a year, taking out whenever he visited a public place so that fans could see it up close. So he's definitely an interesting personality. He is sort of teased a lot in essay articles. I feel like whenever we've done research on the Warriors from this time, Rick Barry or whoever, there's always a line about, you know, sort of joking around with him. But he was a shrewd businessman and, you know, and did seem like actually a pretty decent guy. He had an interesting relationship with Rick Barry where, you know, he kind of felt a little bit betrayed that Rick left the team and then, like, pursued getting Barry back like, you know, like Captain Ahab in the White Whale. You know, he's trying to, you know, he did all this, you know, legal fight to get him back. And, you know, there was these lawsuits. And eventually Barry signed a contract with the Warriors, but then he had to go back to the ABA for a few years because, you know, he had a valid contract with the Squires and later the Nets. And then finally he comes back to the Warriors. And then there's this, you know, the kind of feel good story of, you know, Barry finally coming back and then bringing the championship a few years later with this team that of sort of, you know, of underdogs. And so it's just sort of interesting to he was an interesting person, that's for sure.
Yeah, he absolutely. And the Warriors, I mean, they were looking like they might not even survive as well. I know the because he was a part of local investors initially, and they were going to back out, and he basically purchased the rest of the shares so that he could become the sole owner. And he wasn't a guy that made a ton of money. I mean, he was a rich man, of course, but, you know, he basically just did like radio. I think he was an owner of some radio stations and stuff. So for him, he basically poured all of his money to just keep the team there, and eventually, you know, ended up, as you said, being super successful and, you know, just a pretty decent guy. I mean, of all the owners we talk about, his eccentric thing is he kind of dressed a little weird, but he's a very good businessman and what appears to be a very good guy as well, just all around.
Yeah, exactly. So, all right. Well, thanks for checking us out. You can find us at horrorproxism.com. If you're enjoying what you're hearing, please leave us a rating and review on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you listen to your podcast. And you can give us any feedback you would like on our Basketball Mysteries of the 1970s series or whatever you would like. You can, we're on Twitter and Facebook at Over and Back NBA. So thanks for listening. And until next time, we'll see you again soon.